The headlines, thousands of people rally against Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Tel Aviv. The British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak calls for radical action in his country's crisis-hit healthcare system. And China lifts quarantine requirements for inbound travelers after nearly 3 years. Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi. Thousands of demonstrators have gathered in Tel Aviv to protest against the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's new cabinet. The protesters held banners that read, "Together against fascism and apartheid," and "Prime Minister." The protesters also denounced judicial reforms proposed by the new justice minister. Opposition parties say the proposed judicial reforms allow parliament to override decisions of the Supreme Court. Netanyahu, who is fighting corruption charges, took office late last month, and his new cabinet is regarded as the most right-wing in Israeli history. Meanwhile, Israel revokes entry permits for three senior officials from the Fatah party after they visited the longest-serving Palestinian prisoner following his release. The three Palestinian officials had visited Karim Yunus in his home village of Ara in Haifa district. Israel said the decision was made after the three men took advantage of their status. The regime also said that the decision is part of Israel's response to the Palestinian Authority's decision to wage political and legal war against Tel Aviv by initiating an anti-Israeli motion at the UN. This a week after the UN General Assembly adopted a resolution calling on the International Court of Justice to comment on Israel's occupation of Palestinian territories. The UAE's ambassador to the UN accuses certain states of politicizing the Syrian chemical weapons file. Lana Zaki has severely criticized attempts made by certain countries to politicize the Syrian chemical weapons case. Nusaybe asked all parties in the Security Council to professionally consider the matter in line with the non-politicization of the Organization for Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. Despite Abu Dhabi's role in instigating the Syrian conflict by supporting foreign-backed militants and spreading misinformation, the Emirati government has recently adopted a diplomatic approach to normalize ties with Damascus. The Western media and governments have repeatedly alleged that Syrian government used chemical weapons against its own citizens in the war against terrorists. Now, that is while Syria surrendered its stockpile of chemical weapons in 2014 to join a mission led by the United States. A recent visit by the UAE's foreign minister has sparked anger among U.S. officials and rekindled their bullying tactics. They are telling the UAE that any attempt to normalize ties with the Assad government will prove costly. The UAE is not taking kindly to these threats.
Sheikh Abdulaziz bin Zayed's recent trip to Damascus was the second time he met with the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad as the two Arab nations continued to warm up to each other. The two top diplomats discussed restoration of relations and boosting of economic ties, with Assad saying that they will help regional stability and Sheikh Abdullah expressing support for a diplomatic solution to the conflict in Syria, as he was joined by a group of economic and security officials on his visit. Relations between Syria and the UAE were severed after Syria was expelled from the 22-member Arab League all the way back in 2011. The UAE reopened its embassy in Syria in 2018. Bahrain, Algeria, and Jordan have also resumed ties with Syria, while other Arab nations are calling for Syria's reinstation to the Arab League. This trend has not been sitting well with the US, as officials have slammed the visit by Sheikh Abdullah. One U.S. senator has even threatened the UAE with sanctions in a tweet in typical Twitter fashion. UAE's outreach to the Assad regime provides little benefits to the Emirates. This carries huge risks to UAE's reputation, exposes it to Caesar sanctions, and hurts efforts to seek accountability for Assad's crimes against the Syrian people. The Caesar sanctions refers to the Caesar Syria Civilian Protection Act of 2019, also known as the Caesar Act. It is a U.S. legislation that not only sanctions the Syrian government, but also any entity, organization, or individual that provides funding or assistance to it. Iranian and Russian entities have been sanctioned under this act. It follows a pattern in U.S.'s attitude towards its foreign relations. If they don't want to conduct business with a country, no other country should be allowed to either. Sheikh Abdulaziz had criticized the Caesar Act back in 2021 during a meeting with his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov. He said, "Bigger challenge today facing coordination and working with Syria is the Caesar Act," and further added, "To keep the Caesar Act as it is today makes this path very difficult, not only for us as a nation, but also for the private sector." To those comments, the U.S. replied that it would not ease up on its stances towards Syria, a stance they have maintained to this day, as apparent by their latest remarks surrounding the latest meeting between Turkish and Syrian officials.
Syrian and Turkish defense ministers have held talks for the first time since 2011. This has prompted the U.S. Department of State to reiterate opposition to any kind of normalization of ties with the Syrian government.
In the first time that Ankara and Damascus held talks among their high-ranking officials since 2012, defense ministers of both countries met in Moscow at the end of December. In that meeting, Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Çavuşoğlu said that he expects to meet with his Syrian and Russian counterpart later this month. This is a significant shift in Turkey's attitude towards Syria, as Ankara severed ties with the Arab nation back in 2012. And this shift has been met with a swift response from the U.S. When asked about the issue by reporters, Department of State spokesman Ned Price said, "We've made very clear to all of our allies and partners that now is not the time to normalize relations. Now is not the time to upgrade relations. Instead, in the eyes of the U.S., now is the time to impose further crippling sanctions on Syria, where the humanitarian conditions are deteriorating day by day, as the sanctions also include medicinal supplies." A UN special rapporteur on the negative impacts of unilateral coercive measures visited Syria and said that the sanctions have had catastrophic effects on the lives of Syrians as the country grapples with food and medicine shortages. She also said, "In the current dramatic and still deteriorating humanitarian situation, as 12 million Syrians grapple with food insecurity, I urge the immediate lifting of all unilateral sanctions that severely harm human rights and prevent any efforts for early recovery, rebuilding, and reconstruction." Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said on Thursday that he may meet his Syrian counterpart as part of a new peace process in the wake of the country's defense minister's meeting. An Erdogan-Assad meeting will signal the official failure of U.S. attempts to topple the Syrian government through sanctions and boycotts, as it will show that U.S. allies are no longer listening to the will of America. It will cause embarrassment for the U.S., not quite on the level of their exodus in Afghanistan, but not too far off either.
Today marks the third anniversary of Iran's ballistic missile attack against the U.S. Ain al-Assad air base in Iraq's western province of Al-Anbar. The raid was carried out in retaliation for the assassination of Iran's top commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps unleashed more than a dozen ballistic missiles on that base. This caused significant damage, while the Pentagon said more than 100 American forces suffered traumatic brain injuries. The attack in January 2020 was the largest of its kind in modern history. Iran called it a first slap in the face of the U.S. and vowed harsher revenge in the future. The missile strike came as Iran laid to rest General Soleimani, who, along with his comrades, was killed in a U.S. drone strike near Baghdad Airport. General Soleimani played a pivotal role in the fight against Daesh terrorists in Iraq and Syria. And one person is killed after Russia resumes bombing eastern Ukrainian regions, ending a self-declared ceasefire along the front line that lasted 36 hours. The death was from shelling that hit the northern region of Kharkiv. Ukrainian officials also reported explosions across the border of Donbass region, which has been the front line for months. The truce was announced by Moscow for the Orthodox Christmas celebrations, which fell on a Friday on Saturday. But Kiev rejected the ceasefire. The Kremlin now says that Moscow will push ahead with the war until victory is achieved. The UK Prime Minister calls for radical actions to reform Britain's crisis-hit healthcare system. Rishi Sunak made the remarks in an emergency meeting with the British health leaders. He said bold moves should be taken, like the ones during the COVID pandemic, to resolve the crisis. The meeting comes as the U.S. is witnessing a rare strike by health workers who want a salary hike at a time when inflation has soared to record levels in the country. Britain has faced a wave of industrial action over the last few months, with strikes crippling various sectors. The government is planning to introduce a new law that would make it harder for key workers to strike. John Ross, a senior fellow at Chungnyang Institute, shares his views with us about the way the UK government is responding to the protests and strikes by workers across the country.
It's one of a series of authoritarian government measures that they've taken. They've introduced very draconian rights on the right of people to peacefully demonstrate, for example. And then you have the harassment of anybody, of very severe punishment, as with, for example, Assange, of anybody who brings out the truth about what the Western governments are up. And it's because they're meeting increase in resistance for their population, and it shows what the character of Western so-called democracy was. As provided you were discussing something which didn't matter, you had free speech. You know, if we wanted to discuss whether traffic lights should be red, yellow and green, or we should change the color to purple or something, doubtless they'd allow free speech on it. But if you have something which actually affects the real situation, then it's clamped down upon. It shows the shallow, hollow sham which Western democracy actually is. And it is indeed increasing authoritarianism. It's one of the most severe cases, but it's very far from being the only case that's going on at the present time.
All European countries are struggling with inflation, but the problems have been more acute in Italy. Inflation rate in that country was the highest since 1985 and 2022, and now Italians are very worried about soaring prices. Max Civelli reports from Rome.
The inflation rate in Italy has been high for a while, breaking record after record. An increasing number of Italians are struggling to make ends meet, fearing that the cost of living pinch could soon turn into pain. The National Bureau of Statistics recently announced that the prices in the country rose more than 8% year-on-year in 2022, jumping to its highest 12-month gain in 37 years.
It is impossible to continue this way. Gas and electricity bills have more than doubled, and the cost of bread and milk is going mad. This is pure madness.
Italy's annual inflation rate in December dropped to 11.6%, down from 11.8% in November, but the cost of living crisis keeps biting businesses and households hard. High energy prices caused by energy supply challenges that followed the Ukraine-Russia war is the main factor contributing to this surge.
The immediate loss of this situation has been the collapse of purchasing power by over 10%, which translates to the net loss of one monthly payment for employed workers. People on low-income wages, such as employees and workmen, which represents 90% of the labour force, are among those suffering the most.
Analysts believe that a combination of high inflation, rising interest rates, and a lack of fiscal support will push Italy and other EU economies into recession.
Month after month, life is becoming increasingly tough. My retirement payment went up 50 euros 2 months ago, but the cost of living has increased by 200 euros each month.
Life is more expensive for those who live on one income only. The cost of renting houses, buying clothes for our kids, food. I can't see how we'll be able to face all this.
With the aim to fight high inflation and put prices under control, the European Central Bank has raised interest rates. The move is likely to hamper the European economy further. Some ministers in the Italian government have strongly criticized the ECB over its aggressive monetary policy that they believe could raise the prospect of recession. Max Civili, Rome.
China has officially ended its quarantine requirements for inbound travelers after nearly 3 years, despite struggling with a nationwide surge of COVID cases. All travelers are still required to test negative for COVID-19 within 48 hours of departure. Mainland China has also opened its borders with Hong Kong. Beijing has ended a hardline zero COVID strategy that involved mandatory quarantines and grueling lockdowns. The containment policy had generated resentment throughout China and led to nationwide protests. Colombia's relations with neighboring Venezuela has improved under the country's first-ever leftist president. The latest sign, Gustavo Petro, has traveled to Venezuela to meet his counterpart, Nicolas Maduro. This is the leader's second meeting since Petro took power from Ivan Duque last August and the official resumption of diplomatic ties a month later. The trip also comes just days after the final reopening of the South American neighbor's shared border that was closed for years. Venezuela severed diplomatic relations with its neighbor in 2019. This happened after Bogota backed Venezuela's opposition leader Juan Guaido as the interim government. And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Yourself. I'm Manandi from India.
I was born actually in London, England.
I'm a journalist by profession.
I'm 20 years old and I'm a student of physics. My dad, who taught me the art of
radio. Listeners special.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Shalom, dear listeners, and greetings to you all. Welcome to another edition of Listeners Special on this beautiful Sunday, January 8, 2023. I'm Atefe Erfani, hosting this program today. Listeners Special is a Sunday program where your views are presented through emails, letters, and messages. So please contact us and tell us what you think about our broadcast. Tell us which program or programs you like the best. And of course, if you have any message for our great listeners around the world, you can record your voice, send it to us, and get your voice heard in this program. Remember, Listeners Special is your program. It's your views that are important. So please don't go away and keep us company until the end of the program. Welcome back. This is Listeners Special, the Sunday program. And here we've received reception reports from around the world from Mazhab Chandra Sagur from India, Fabio Junior da Silva from Brazil, and Lars Escoland from Sweden. So, Mazhab Chandra Sagur, Fabio Junior da Silva, and Lars Escoland, we want you to know how much we value your support and commitment to IRIB English Radio. And we've received piles of letters and emails from around the world, which I mentioned some of your names here and later during the program. I will read these great emails. Nico Genoves from Italy has sent us an email. Alexei Kolakov from Russia has sent us a message. Shah MD Mukarram Hussein from Bangladesh has sent us a piece of email again. From Bangladesh, we've received an email from MD Mizanur Rahman. And then last but not the least is an email from Reginaldo Anunciação from Brazil. Stay with us, please. Again, welcome to the program. Here we have an email from Italy from Nico Genoves. So let's see what Nico says. Dearest friends, I thank you for your warm wishes, which I reciprocate with affection. Let's hope this 2023 will be a better year for all of us. A year of peace and joy. Peace and joy have been the feelings that have accompanied my family's Christmas memories since I was a child. I'm originally from Messina, Sicily. It was tradition in my family to bring all members together at the table. Often the relatives who lived further away and those we hardly saw each other during the rest of the year, gathered around the same table to share happy moments. Now I live in Terracina, a town about 100 kilometers from Rome, and the traditions have not changed. We try to be together as much as possible with the family, only that the roles have changed. Now I am no longer that little boy who was anxiously awaiting the arrival of Christmas and especially the New Year, but now I am a parent who tries to make their children experience the same magic. Dear friends, I greet you again and wish you a serene and fruitful 2023. Nico Genoves from Italy. Salam, ciao. Warm greetings to you and thank you very much for this email. It was very interesting. I mean, sharing your Christmas and new experiences with us and with our great listeners around the world. On behalf of all IRIB English Radio staff, I congratulate you and, of course, all our Christian listeners and friends on the start of 2023. And we wish you all the best. Nico Genoves from Italy. We in Iran celebrate the new year in spring on the first day of the Iranian month of Farvardin. We call it Nowruz, meaning the new year. Anyway, I appreciate you for sharing your New Year and Christmas experience with us. It was really kind of you. So, Nico Genovese from Italy, please accept our EQSL as verification. We wish you all the best and we wish a very happy New Year 2023 to you and your family members. Please write to us soon and, of course, tell us your views about IRIB English radio programs. And from Russia, we've received an email from Alexei Kolakov. Let's see what Alexei tells us. Sorry for the late reply. I want to congratulate you and all listeners on the occasion of the New Year. Happy New Year 2023. Wish you more happiness, health and peace. With very best wishes from Russia. Salam and warm greetings to you. Alexei Kolakov from Russia. These warm greetings to you from Tehran, the capital of the Islamic Republic of Iran. And Happy New Year 2023 to you, Alexei Kolakov from Russia. We wish you all the best. We wish you peace, joy, love, and good tidings to you in 2023. And wish you more happiness, health, and peace. Please write to us soon and tell us your views about IRIB English radio programs. And after a short break, I will be back with you with other emails and letters from around the world. Welcome back. For your information, you just heard a piece of music, Iranian music from southern Iran. I like it very much. And Shah MD Mukarram Hussein from Bangladesh has sent us an email. Let's see what Shah MD Mukarram Hussein from Bangladesh says. Dear IRIB English Radio, I'm very happy that you wished me joy and prosperous year in my crisis time. A few days ago, when it was only me and my mother at home, suddenly she fell down on the floor and lost consciousness. Thank God that time I was present and close to my mother and could take her to the hospital as soon as possible. After taking a CT scan of brain, we found that there is something wrong with her brain. So now I request you and all the listeners of your radio by my heart to make a special prayer for my mother. Thank you. Salam and warm greetings to you, Shah MD Mukarram Hussein from Bangladesh. And thank you for this email. We are so sorry for what happened to your mother. And of course, we all pray for her to recover soon and get better soon. Good health is the greatest gift, I think, that God grants us. So we ask God to give you, your mother, and all your family members good health and prosperity. We are so sorry for this incident. Please write to us soon and let us know if your mother is in a good condition and if she is okay. We all pray for her from the bottom of our heart. Shah MD Mukarram Hussein from Bangladesh. Please write to us soon. Thank you for this email. Again from Bangladesh, we've received an email from MD Mizanur Rahman, one of our old and regular listeners. MD Mizanur Rahman says, Dear IRIB English Radio, I like your reports about international news. Your reports and news programs provide me with the information that I want. Your website is very informative. Anybody can get news and reports on current issues in the world from your website. I thoroughly enjoy learning about your culture and your country. You created an atmosphere where every seeker of the real events can get the gist without sweat, especially through your website updates. I regularly visit this website and get a lot of information. I'm very thankful to all staff for working hard only and for us. I came to know that you often send some promotional items to your regular listeners. Thank you for your cooperation and hope for answers. Salam and warm greetings to you. MD Mizanur Rahman from Bangladesh, and this greeting comes from Tehran, the capital of the Islamic Republic of Iran. And thank you for your support and commitment to IRIB English Radio. We are thankful for hearing this email, the glad news you had that you liked the programs, and we wish you all the best. We are looking forward to hearing from you very soon. And please accept our EQSL as verification, since sending any material on behalf of our radio in the time of pandemic, unfortunately, is not possible. Thank you again, MD Mizanur Rahman from Bangladesh. And after a short break, I will be back with you. And let's go to the Southern Hemisphere, where we've received an email from Reginaldo Anunciaso from Brazil. Let's see what Reginaldo says. A happy new year 2023, and thank you for your sweet message on this very occasion. I should say that I am so happy these days, as I'm going to spend the holiday with my family and friends. Here in Brazil, Christmas is a little different because we are in the Southern Hemisphere and it's actually summer in Brazil. And not only the weather, but also the food and melodies are also different from the countries in the Northern Hemisphere. Thank you again for your beautiful message and Happy New Year to all the listeners. Salam and warm greetings to you. And I do appreciate you for this email. And we wish you peace, joy, love and good tidings in the new year 2023. And of course, we are looking forward to hearing from you very soon. Reginaldo Anunciaso from Brazil, who lives in Southern Hemisphere, and as you said, the weather, the food and melodies are very different from the countries in the Northern Hemisphere, and the atmosphere is in Christmas and the New Year is so different with the people who live in the Northern Hemisphere, just like those people who live in Australia and New Zealand and other countries in the Southern Hemisphere. It was great. Reginaldo Anunciaso from Brazil, write to us soon and tell us your views about IRIB English Radio programs. And here we come to the end of our program. Many thanks for being with us. Please keep in touch with Listeners Special and IRIB English Radio. We wish you all the best. God bless and goodbye.
Dear listeners, your opinion is always important to us. We invite you to spend just a few minutes writing us a letter or sending us an email. We will be glad to hear from all of our listeners who have any questions or comments about any of our programs. Our postal address is IRIB English Service, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. You can also send us emails to englishradio@irib.ir. Please visit our website at parstoday.ir/en. Our phone number is 0098-21-2201-3720. Thank you all for being with IRIB English Radio.
This one lay.
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. The new extreme right-wing Israeli cabinet has started its work with some controversial and provocative moves, although it has assumed power for only about a week. The visit by the hardliner minister Itamar Ben-Gavir to Al-Aqsa Mosque earlier this week drew widespread condemnations from not only the Muslim world, but even the U.S. The same minister has visited Nafa prison today to make sure the conditions of the inmates have not improved and that they don't have, quote, excessive rights, a move that Hamas has slammed as an unprecedented criminal act. The Tel Aviv regime has also issued financial and political sanctions against the Palestinian Authority. We'll discuss these issues in tonight's Spotlight program with our guests. Kevin Barrett, editor of Veterans Today, joining us from Madison. And also Lebanese journalist Sandos Al-Assad, joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, it's great to have you with us. Let's start off with Mr. Barrett in Madison. The United Nations Security Council has voiced concern about the status quo of the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound following this provocative visit by the Israeli minister. That's just more platitudes and no action. Why did the Security Council yet again fail to act against another Israeli violation?
Well, the UN Security Council has been running interference for the Zionists for quite some time. Even though the Zionists are the biggest international outlaws and criminals, the violators of the most UN resolutions of any country on earth, they're still given a pass. And probably a lot of the reason for that is that they have so much power in several of the countries that make up the Security Council. So we shouldn't expect the United Nations to solve this problem, certainly not the Security Council as it's currently structured. If it were changed and restructured and became more reflective of the world's population, then that might change. But as it stands right now, this most extreme Israeli government in history, with people like Ben-Gavir, who basically worships Baruch Goldstein, the perpetrator of the Hebron massacre, a serial killer and maniac, and Ben-Gavir used to have a big picture of him on his wall that he bowed to, I guess. This guy is a complete, there's really nobody. There's no genocidal maniac on earth today that you could find that could really beat this guy in the sweepstakes for that title. He's now taking up where a long list of other Zionist extremists have left off in terms of provoking violence by attacking the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the oldest and greatest Islamic architectural monument, and trying to set the stage ultimately for demolishing it, as many of these maniacal, ultra-extremist, messianic, millenarian Zionists want to do. So he's taking up where people like Ariel Sharon left off prior to 9/11, when Sharon's job was to set the stage for the post 9/11 crushing of the Palestinians in the run up to that Israeli demolition of the Twin Towers in New York. So these guys right now in this current government are just completely beyond the pale in terms of anything that even ultra-Zionists like Thomas Friedman of the New York Times can even imagine ever stomaching. And yet the United Nations and the international community are letting them get away with it. And it makes you wonder, what wouldn't they let them get away with?
Ms. Al-Assad, at the United Nations Security Council session, the Palestinian UN envoy said, quote, "What red line must be crossed for the Security Council to finally say enough is enough?" I think it's safe to say that many of those red lines have already been crossed by the Israelis on numerous occasions.
I believe that the United Nations is complicit in the atrocities that have been held against the Palestinians. The United Nations, we have seen how the United Nations act with double standards policy regarding the issue of Iran, for example, the issue of Russia, the issue of China. They all the time condemn these countries while and sanction them, but they don't sanction the usurping occupation entity. So I don't believe that the United Nations will do justice for the Palestinians. The only thing that will do justice for the Palestinians is the righteous right of resistance. This is the only option that the Palestinians must uphold, because the Zionists are there's no a good Zionist and a bad Zionist. The old Zionists are occupiers, and the Palestinians have the right to defend themselves and to get rid of this occupation.
Kevin Barrett, the Israelis, as we've seen, act with impunity as they are above the law. How has the insufficient international response and lack of action from international bodies such as the UN, the EU, the OIC, and most notably Arab governments contributed to this status quo?
Well, the international institutions are set up to fail. We don't have real international institutions now. What we have is a kind of a set of institutions, starting with the United Nations, that are fig leaves for the protection of power by the powerful. And for that reason, there was never any real intent to have these institutions enforce any kind of just international law. Instead, they provide cover, again, for, like, the U.S. wanted to wage a war in Korea, so they got the United Nations to approve the Korean War, and right on through the Iraq War, these other kinds of interventions. We always see that the United Nations is not representing a majority of the people of the planet. It's essentially just, again, providing cover for the biggest imperial and state interests. So the real question here is not so much why have the international institutions failed. That's what they do. That's what they're designed to do. But rather, why haven't any national governments tried to do something about this? And the national governments that we would expect to stand up for the Palestinians would be the regional governments, the Arab countries, the Palestinians or their fellow Arabs, and of course the Muslim world, and to some extent one would expect the Christian world as well to not particularly appreciate the way the Zionists are committing genocide against Christians in the traditional home of Christianity. But none of those governments, with a very few exceptions, the Islamic Republic of Iran is one of them, have been doing anything to try to stand up for the Palestinians. And they mostly have, in the past, pretended to be, you know, they give lip service, and every now and then one of them has actually helped out the Palestinians. Saddam Hussein did that in Iraq. Muammar Gaddafi did that in Libya. And then they paid the price. And I think the other leaders in the region sort of got the message that the Zionist-controlled West is going to come in and make your life miserable unless you dance to their tune. And so the people of the region, as we saw in the World Cup, are completely opposed to Zionism and virtually unanimous in their ardent desire for the liberation of Palestine. But most of the leaders in the region are not in line with that, because they find it's more in their interest to play ball with the world's biggest powers. And what will make that change, I don't know. Maybe as the Palestinian The Palestinian resistance becomes more popular worldwide, including here in the West. Even in the Jewish communities of the West, the younger people tend to be more sympathetic to Palestinians. And as the people in the region put pressure on their governments, maybe that will bring some change.
Ms. Al-Assad, what do you see behind this latest wave of Israeli aggression and provocations, especially the recent storming of Al-Aqsa by the far-right minister Itamar Ben-Gvir? Why now?
Because, unfortunately, the rulers, the so-called Muslim rulers, are complicit in these aggressions that are being taken in Al-Aqsa Mosque, desecrating Al-Aqsa Mosque and killing the Palestinians. Four Palestinian children have been killed since the onset of this new year. We saw that the Arab monarchs, the Persian Gulf monarchs, are normalizing ties with the Zionists, shamefully normalizing ties with this occupation, and doing nothing to the Palestinians. They said that the so-called Abraham Accords will bring peace and justice for the Palestinians. We haven't seen this justice. The only thing, as I have mentioned earlier, that will bring justice for the Palestinians is the armed resistance. The armed resistance is the key for freeing the Palestinians and supporting them. And as we are marking in these days the martyrdom of Hashqasem Soleimani has done what the Palestinians deserve and what do better for the Palestinians, which is supporting the armed resistance and helping those resistance factions. And this what happened in the recent years. We have seen that while the Arab governments and monarchs have moved into normalization, the Palestinian units are getting closer to each other and uniting their efforts against this aggression. And I believe that the more the aggressive the Zionists will be, the more our resistance will unite and will bring this illegitimate entity into its immediate and eventual collapse.
Kevin Barrett, our Ramallah correspondent, has said to us many times that Israel is planning to split up Al-Aqsa Mosque in terms of space and time, and that any attempt to change the mosque status quo will explode the existing tensions. How important is it for the status quo of Al-Aqsa to remain intact, and what repercussions would there be if that's not the case?
Well, that's right. There's been a kind of a tenuous peace. I guess peace isn't maybe quite the right word for it, given the ongoing slow-motion genocide of Palestine. But we haven't seen a kind of third world war along religious lines break out, in part because the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which again is the Islamic world's oldest and greatest architectural monument and the spiritual symbol of the universality of the Islamic message, as the symbol of the Miraj of the Prophet Muhammad, peace upon him, who encountered all of the other prophets, including the founding prophets of Christianity and Judaism, as he ascended into the nearness of God. That great symbol and that great monument means everything to the Muslims. And the Zionists have a kind of a millenarian messianic mythology that spun off into outright Satanism with Shabtai Zvi in 1666. And those Satanists who have spun off from Judaism and Zionism are dedicated to bringing their false Messiah, their Dajjal or Antichrist, to rule the world by destroying the Al-Aqsa Mosque and building a blood sacrifice temple from which the world will be ruled. This is this bizarre millenarian messianic mythology that the ultra-Zionists, and perhaps including Ben-Gvir and his friends, believe in. So keeping the inviolability of the Al-Aqsa Mosque is absolutely paramount in terms of preventing massive global bloodshed if the Zionists do decide to either try to destroy or to take over a portion of this mosque, which Ben-Gvir has announced his intention to do. It's a huge issue. And this is the kind of issue that at least should be talked about honestly in the United Nations, but it hasn't been. And the world's biggest powers that have every reason not to want some kind of huge explosion there that could destabilize the world and interfere with their own interests even, have been slow to talk about this and to try to find a solution to it, because the Zionists, again, they have so much power. And for the Zionists, that control the Western media, that dominate Western finance, even though most of them are not Ben-Gavirs themselves, are not that fanatically attached to destroying the Al-Aqsa Mosque and putting up a blood sacrifice temple to usher in the reign of the Antichrist. A few of them probably are, but most of them aren't. But they still have this mentality that Jewish interests can do no wrong. And so they won't let the Western governments do anything about this.
Ms. Al-Aqsa, let's talk about the actions of the new extremist Israeli cabinet at just a weekend. To name one instance, there was a visit by the fascist minister Itamar Ben-Gavir to Nafa prison with the aim of harassing the Palestinian prisoners there. Hamas has, of course, responded to that. It's called this an unprecedented criminal act, adding that the extremist occupation government is planning a dangerous escalation that our people will not let it go unnoticed. Are the Israelis, with this new far-right cabinet at its helm, in search of escalating tensions, in your opinion?
I believe that this reckless actions, unfortunately, the Zionists don't learn lessons from their previous experiences. We have seen what happened last summer, last May, during Saif al-Aqsa operations. Unfortunately, they don't learn lessons that as long as they insist in desecrating our holy places and killing our people and murdering our people, their option to resistance became more substantial and more and it's the only key to put an end for these aggressions. I believe that the Muslim population across the globe, especially here in West Asia, must pressure their governments. They must use the alternative media to expose these violations, and to work hard to support the Palestinians, and also the Palestinians must unite, must exert all the possible efforts in order to put an end for these aggressions. I don't believe that the Zionists. I believe that the Zionists take these measures in order to risk to provocate the Palestinians, but the Palestinians will respond, and this is their right to respond and to resist these aggressions.
Kevin Barrett, the office of the new Israeli Prime Minister has just announced financial and political sanctions against the Palestinian Authority in response to their appeal at the International Court of Justice. The regime will also impose a moratorium on some Palestinian construction as well. What are the Israelis trying to achieve with these actions?
Well, they're trying to punish the Palestinian Authority for, in this case, doing the right thing, going to the International Criminal Court, Court of Justice, and trying to get some justice for some of these crimes that have been committed against them. And, of course, the old saying is no good deed goes unpunished. And so the Zionists are punishing the Palestinian Authority for doing something right. And, of course, the Palestinian Authority has done wrong things as well, and it has made too many accommodations with Zionist power. The Zionists think they own the Palestinian Authority, and to some extent they have. They've had a lot of influence over it in the past, at certain points at least. But now I guess they're trying to rein it in, and they're saying, well, if you give in to popular opinion and press these war crimes charges against us, then we will do what we can to make your life more difficult. So that's the sort of thing the Zionists always do. They're always finding ways to retaliate against anyone that's either done something to them or that they imagine has done something to them. And so this Actually, it could be a good thing if the Palestinian leaders realize that it's time to stop dealing with the Zionists. Alan Hart, the former BBC lead correspondent for the for Israel-Palestine, personal friend of Yasser Arafat, Golda Meir, used to say in the last years of his life that the Palestinian Authority really should dissolve itself, and that would make the Israeli occupier 100% responsible for everything happening in the occupied territories, and that would put the ball in the next court. And maybe it's time for the Palestinians to do that. But in any case, this will force the PA closer to the views of the majority of their people.
And Ms. al-Assad, Hamas has pledged to defend al-Aqsa at any price. Islamic Jihad has said Israel is responsible for the repercussions of its actions. The PA has said before that any aggression against al-Aqsa is equivalent to crossing all red lines. Now, Russia's UN envoy in the recent Security Council session recounted the events that took place back in the year 2000 after Ariel Sharon stormed al-Aqsa, sparking the second Palestinian intifada. Analysts and observers say we could be looking at the prelude for a third intifada. How do you see it?
The entire axis of resistance has actually warned against another intifada, because as we have mentioned that the Zionist occupation is manifesting on a daily basis its aggressive hostilities against the Palestinians, against our holy places, murdering Palestinians, Palestinian minors, women, and with full impunity, because the Zionist occupation knows that no one will hold them accountable. And as we see that as I've mentioned, that the Persian Gulf monarchies are turning deaf ears and blind eyes to these aggressions and getting closer to the Zionist enemy. And we see that Ansarullah has warned against the aggressive policies of the Zionist enemy, also Hezbollah in Lebanon. We witness the aggressions on a daily basis that are targeting Syria, also the Judaization of Manama in Bahrain. All of these movements that are taking place by the Zionist enemy will lead eventually, yes, to another intifada, and perhaps it's time that we will witness the collapse of this temporary Zionist occupation in our West Asia region.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. Allow me to thank my guests, editor at Veterans Today, Kevin Barra, joining us from Madison, and Lebanese journalist Sandos al-Assad, joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. And a special thanks to you all for staying with us on Spotlight. It's good night for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
questions and answers.